It's here and now. Bill Bryson's longtime fans know what they're in for when they pick up one of his books. First of all, it will be heavy, and they will receive a rich story filled with intimate details about things they thought they knew well. Case in point, his latest book, One Summer. We all know that Charles Lindbergh made his historic crossing of the Atlantic in 1927, but Bill Bryson reminds us that when he took off at Long Island's Roosevelt Field, the plane was so heavy with fuel it almost snagged low-hanging telephone wires. Charles Lindbergh's solo crossing of the Atlantic is just one of the dozens of events that Bill Bryson writes about in his book, One Summer, America, 1927. It was a fateful summer and a fateful year, and Bill Bryson joins us in the studio with more. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
I want you to do, as you do at the end of the book, as you sum them up, tick off the major events of the summer of 1927.
Gosh, there were so many. The Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs. Charles Lindbergh, as you say, flew the Atlantic. They filmed The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, which obviously transformed popular entertainment. It was the summer that they started carving Mount Rushmore. Calvin Coolidge astounded the world by announcing that he didn't want to run for re-election. There was a really juicy murder case called the Sashwaite murder case, which strangely just completely gripped the nation and much of the rest of the world. And it was just one thing after another. Venture of television. All of these things really, really did happen in one summer.
Well, let's go back to that Sashwaite murder, because it was one of the things I had absolutely no awareness of, and yet it led to two books which became movies, A Double Indemnity and The Postman Never Rings Twice, Always Rings Twice. Tell us about this case and how it captivated people.
If you've ever seen the film Double Indemnity, that's what it was. A woman, Ruth Snyder, who grew disenchanted with her poor, innocuous husband, and took out a double indemnity life insurance policy on him. And with her lover, a hapless man named Judd Gray, they decided to knock his head in with using a window sash weight as this poor man slept in bed.
Well, by the way, can I jump in? Mm-hmm. As happened many times as I was reading, I found myself saying, and what again is a window sash weight?
It's the weight that inside the window frame that pulls the window up and down. And, I mean, why they used a sash weight, I don't know. But it gave the case a kind of an exotic name for a start. But it was in every respect, I mean, both incompetent and really banal. They murdered this poor man, Albert Snyder, in his bed as he slept. And then they were so incompetent that they were arrested almost immediately. Within hours, the case was solved.
And I shouldn't have chuckled as I did, because it's terrible. Somebody's murdered with a sash weight. But just give us a sense, because we tend to think this is the time when we are consumed with stories that spread on social media. But give us a sense of how it reverberated then.
Yeah, but what was interesting about it was very, very symptomatic of the age, because a new phenomenon had just come into American life, and that was the tabloid newspaper. And tabloid, not just in the format, but also in the kind of attitude. You know, tabloids were based all around really two things, salacious things and gossip and celebrity news. Both of those were really new phenomena in the 20s. And the reason I started the book with that was not only chronologically this murder really sort of kicked off the summer of 1927, but also those were themes that run throughout that summer, because with Charles Lindbergh and Babe Ruth in particular, the whole rise of celebrity culture was very, very significant. It had a big impact on both their lives. Lindbergh absolutely hated it. Babe Ruth, on the other hand, wholly embraced it, loved to be a celebrity.
Well, stay with Charles Lindbergh. Tell me something, and you do, that we don't know about Charles Lindbergh, because so much has been written.
The only thing that I've brought to it is that by compressing it down to one summer, by just looking at one summer, I am able to look in more detail just about the effect that this summer had on Lindbergh. And you have to bear in mind, this was a 25-year-old kid from Minnesota. He had no distinction at all. Nobody had ever heard of him. He flies into New York. I didn't realize at the time there were lots and lots of other teams of aviators that were all poised to make the flight from New York to Paris. But from out of the blue, there comes this kid proposes to fly alone without a navigator or a co-pilot, not even a radio in his plane, in a single-engine plane. Everybody thought he was out of his mind. He flies across the ocean, and of course, as we all know, he succeeded. But in the time that he left New York and landed in Paris, the whole world was just on the edge of its seat. It was just sort of delirious with anticipation. Would this kid make it or not? And when he landed, the joy and euphoria were so intense that the whole world really erupted in this moment of joy that was spread and share it all around the world. And I think that's a completely unique event.
Well, you also remind us about something that happened during Prohibition. We might think, what have we not heard about Prohibition? Well, I didn't know that at one point the U.S. government actually poisoned alcohol so that people wouldn't drink it.
It wasn't just that they poisoned alcohol so people wouldn't drink it. They poisoned alcohol so that, you know, if people did drink it, they wouldn't
they
do
die.
It again.
Yeah.
That was, I think, the single most astounding fact that I learned, you know, that the U.S. government was intentionally, willfully adulterating alcohol with very, very severe poison, strychnine and mercury, on purpose. So if it was diverted and turned into bootleg alcohol, it would, at the very least, maim and blind people, but very often kill them. And apparently very large numbers of people were killed.
We're speaking with One Summer America 1927 author Bill Bryson. You're listening to Here and Now. And Bill, how did you come to do this huge book? It switches topics every few pages. Each chapter has been books, you know, has been, you know, written up as a book by other authors. How did you come to this summer?
Yeah, well, there's a fair point that you sort of touch on there, which is an awful lot of these things, Al Capone, Charles Lindbergh, Babe Ruth, an awful lot of the stuff that I touch on, I would guess probably at least three quarters of it has all been written about before. But I also do really genuinely feel that by looking, by sort of freezing a moment, by going to just this one summer when all of this stuff was happening and when it was all interacting with each other and influencing each other in sort of ways that are not normally noticed, that you get a completely different perspective and you can actually see how this was a time when America was changing in a really fundamental way. If you just think about the kind of American attitude in World War I with the kind of American attitude in World War II. In World War I, we were allies and participants, latecomers, but we participated. World War II, we ran the show, you know. And the thing that happened in 1927 was that America was becoming the top nation on Earth and knew it. And that was a real psychological difference between before that period and after that period. Within a decade of 1927, America was not just the most economically powerful nation on Earth, but it knew it, and it expected to be the global leader in almost every area.
The summer sees the end of anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti. It may be the beginning of the Depression. I mean, just quite a time. But you also remind us at the end of the book that something so incredible as the flight of Lindbergh is so, we know about it, but if you go back to Roosevelt Field on Long Island, it's a shopping center with a little plaque.
Yes.
Where is the point at which he started?
According to the plaque, which you have to hunt around for, inside the shopping center, it's a nice, very handsome New York State Historical Society plaque, but it's underneath an escalator just outside the Disney store. That was the biggest disappointment, probably my whole adult life, really, because I went there, and I knew it was a shopping center. I knew it wasn't going to be, you know, an airstrip and everything. But you stand there and there's absolutely no possibility, however good an imagination you have, there's no possibility of recreating in your mind's eye what had once been there. And it wasn't just Lindbergh, it was all these other historic flights that left from there. And you look around and you can't imagine that it ever was there. It's just so totally obliterated.
Well, if you want to reimagine it in your mind's eye, you can by reading Bill Bryson's book, One Summer, America, 1927. Go back to that Long Island that once was. Bill Bryson, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Jeremy Hobson, there at KJZZ in Phoenix, you have a last word here?
I do, Robin. A few moments ago in our story about the housing market, I referred to the suburb of Tempe. Well, in fact, out here they call it Tempe.
Ah.
Tempe, not Tempe. So I apologize to all the residents of Tempe.
You see, you should have reported from Monkey's Eyebrow, Arizona. One of my favorite
Next
name
time.
Towns, yes.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.